Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Join the conversation.
Join the conversation.
You're with Cape Talk.
It is 25 to 10. Good morning. Welcome to today. Kino Cummings with you all the way through until midday. Got Vian making sure that all things move smoothly, and you will also have Walid answering your phone calls. Now, always great to welcome back the naked scientist, Dr. Chris Smith.
Morning, Kino. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. My blood pressure's gone down.
Why is that?
Oh, no. I played a bit of a giggle when I heard that Trump had coronavirus. And then someone said, why did you do that? I said, well, you know what? If you're not going to wear a mask and you're encouraging people not to wear masks and then you catch it yourself, then I can't feel sorry for you because it's the height of stupidity to do something like that. That's why. Anyway, so
I think it's extraordinary, to be honest with you, that he's managed to go so long without catching it, because these viruses are really very infectious. And it's quite extraordinary that someone as connected and networked and busy as that in terms of getting into contact with people. Because, you know, Prince Charles, right at the beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, he caught it. He had to isolate himself away for 10 days while he recovered. Thankfully, he did. He was okay. It's really extraordinary to me that Donald Trump has only this time got it. I wonder if it might be a reinfection. Perhaps he's had it before. I don't know. But it is extraordinary he hasn't caught it previously. But people are obviously quite worried for his health because, you know, everything else aside, you've got to look at the individual's health, and everyone's a human being. This individual is 76, 75, 74? Yeah, mid-70s, 74, I think, 74 years old. He's also got a number of comorbidities. Apart from being older and putting him in a higher risk bracket, he is overweight, if not obese, and we know that that's a big risk factor as well. So everyone's saying, well, we hope he's going to be okay.
Yeah, at the end of the day, Chris, if you caught it and you get it and you put other people, I'm just saying from my side, I can't feel sorry for someone who gets given advice from the best scientists out there, some of the best in the world, and yet you do very little to protect yourself by never wearing a mask. And you certainly don't encourage the people who follow you to do so. So
this is the same person, Kino, right? Who said you should shoot up disinfectant and shine UV lights up people's backsides in order to deal with coronavirus. You've got to take all this with a pinch of salt, really, haven't you? I mean, a lot of this is bluster. It's political bluster. Here in the UK today, we've got our own scandal going on because we've got a member of the Scottish Parliament who felt iffy last weekend, was sufficiently unwell to request a test for coronavirus. She then boarded a public train. She travelled all the way to London, spent the weekend and the following Monday in meetings, got a positive test result on Monday, and then boarded a train back home. The hypocrisy of some of these so-called leaders, it's appalling. And this is the same person that called out an individual from the opposite side of the political spectrum when they took a journey in a private car to go to somewhere early in the year to isolate themselves. That was Dominic Cummings. This woman, Margaret Ferrier, she doesn't seem to kind of get that putting herself in that space is not setting a good example. It's putting people at risk, but also it completely undermines all of the messaging that enormous amounts of money are being spent distributing to people to say this is what you've got to do to try to cut down rates of infection. And it really is interesting, the behavioural psychology of this. Where are these people coming from? What's their mindset that it's one rule here in Parliament for us to legislate for everyone else having to do these things. But when it comes to the individual, they do something completely opposite. She must have known in the first instance that she was sufficiently unwell, I need to request a test. But then with the positive result in hand, then does exactly the same thing again. I just don't understand where these people are coming from. They're clearly bright people, exactly. Right? They're running countries. So what is on their mind? I just don't understand their mindset.
And it affects so many people. It affects hundreds and thousands and millions of people who look up to you. And listen, nobody wants Donald. I don't want Donald Trump to die, right? I just find it funny that the same man who's been telling everybody, oh, no, it's not a big, it's a bit like the cold and whatever, whatever, now catches it. So, I mean, that's slightly hilarious. But I don't think anybody wants him to die. I might not agree with his politics, but you never wish death on anybody. I mean, that would be a step too far. But I do think, though, that through the type of messaging, not just word of mouth and what he's actually said, it's also how he walks around without a mask and how he makes it look okay. And when he taunts other people for wearing masks, then you're looking, oh, well, you know, the president doesn't wear a mask. Why should I?
But the other question here, Kino, is they all took part in a very vigorous, shall we say, televised debate. The amount of shouting that was going on, I mean, it's made headlines, just the fact that how hard it was for the person who was trying to chair and curate that debate, it was for them to keep a lid on it. Now, we know that when people shout, yell, scream, even just talk and breathe, they're spraying out droplets. So one has to ask, has this infection actually taken down everybody across the political spectrum who matters in this presidential run-up? Can you imagine that? Because if they all end up with it, this is going to really be interesting, isn't it? Let's hope that they haven't spread it further. We don't want anyone to catch this who doesn't have to. But it's a possibility because we know that people are infectious for a period of time before they even manifest symptoms. So he could have been infectious at the time at which they were having that slanging match and filling the air with droplets. And therefore, other people could well have caught this. And then there's the sort of legal side of this, which is, I've been involved medically in cases where people have sought my advice because individuals have knowingly infected other individuals with infections. In this case, it was things like HIV and herpes viruses, but they have life-changing consequences. Now, if it turns out that that member of the Scottish Parliament has infected people and it can be proven because of her actions, I wonder if she will face legal challenge, for example, because if someone has life-changing consequences of catching coronavirus and they can prove they got it from her, difficult to do, but not impossible, there could be a whole train of sort of legal roll-on effects from this. I think it's going to be very interesting how this plays out, actually.
I'm going to be keeping a keen eye on it, absolutely. Now, we've got some calls coming through. We'll start with Oliver with a very cute question, actually. I had the same question. It's a good one, Oliver, so let's start with you, sir. Good to have you on the show.
Morning, Kino, thanks. I'd like to know why toddlers have pot bellies.
Oliver, I hate to break it to you, but it's not just toddlers who have pot bellies. As many of us who, as we get older, discover this is a thing called middle-aged spread, but I think that's something slightly different, isn't it? The answer is that toddlers, when they're growing, they don't just take energy in and immediately convert it into muscles and bones and all the other structures that are a growing child. Their metabolism works in a certain way. Their body structure and shape is organized in a certain way. And as a result, they might get what looks like a beer gut. But that's just because they're packing a lot into a small area. They also tend to store up energy in the form of fat and flab and then convert that into growth. Because at peak, an individual, a growing human, can turn 30% of the calories that they eat in any given day into growth. And so there's a range of things here. It's storing energy for growth. It's the fact that they're a slightly different shape and other bits of them are growing at the different rates to other bits. So bits look disproportionately big. And that's the main reason. There's one other reason why toddlers, and this is a sad story, can have a pot belly, and that's because they've got health problems. And in some poorer countries, you will see individuals who have problems with parasites if they get certain worms and that kind of thing, which can invade the intestinal system and cause problems for their liver. And specifically, I'm thinking about bilharzia and schistosomiasis can do this. This can also cause fluid to build up in the abdomen, and that can cause a pot belly. And then there are children who are malnourished. and conditions like kwashiorkor, where individuals don't have enough protein in their daily diet. They're on a very poor, nutrient-poor diet, and the low level of protein in their diet means they can't make enough protein to keep the fluid in their blood vessels, and as a result, fluid leaks out around the body and they can get a swollen abdomen. That's another reason why, and you'll see sometimes children who are malnourished, and you may see television footage, for instance, where there's been a famine, and you think, I don't understand, these children, they're malnourished, but they have a sticking out tummy. Why is that? And it's because of this condition where they have a build-up of fluid because they can't make enough protein because their diet's so poor. Thankfully, that's more rare. It's mainly because as children grow up, they're just growing at different rates, and they're also storing energy, and those factors combined mean that they get a bit disproportionate in different bits of their body for a little while.
Okay, thank you very much for asking that question. Oliver, thank you so much for that. Let's go to Roger. Roger's in Durbanville. Hi, Roger. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi Roger.
Hi, Dr. Chris.
Hi there.
I recently read that the ascent speed can contribute to the risk of decompression sickness for free divers. Now, I had always been under the impression that because free divers breathe in air at surface pressure, as opposed to scuba divers who are breathing in compressed air, that they were immune from any form of decompression sickness.
Yeah, the risk is certainly a lot lower, Roger. And the reason is that when you are scuba diving, in order to inflate your lungs underwater, because for every 10 metres you go underwater, that's the equivalent of a whole atmosphere of pressure on you. So if you're 10 metres underwater, you're now experiencing pressure as though you were standing under two Earth atmospheres, not one. And for every 10 metres further you go, it increases by a further atmosphere. And this means that you can't inflate your lungs, because the air in them at the surface is now halved in volume. And as you go down another 10 metres, it's a third of the volume, and so on. So you breathe air in from a tank at pressure, and the regulator delivers that air at the same pressure as the surrounding seawater, so that you take into account the extra water pressure and continue to breathe air at atmospheric pressure. But what that means is the air you're breathing is much denser than it would be at the surface. So you are forcing more air, which includes a healthy helping of nitrogen. Remember, the air is 80% nitrogen, give or take. And it's forcing this relatively insoluble gas to dissolve in the bloodstream. And this means that when you resurface, if you don't resurface sufficiently slowly, the dissolved gas will come out of solution, because it doesn't like, nitrogen's very badly bad at dissolving. It doesn't like dissolving. It'll come out of solution too quickly and it forms bubbles. So then you quite rightly say, well, hang on, if I go down and I've just got atmospheric pressure air in my lungs and I go very, very deep, and these free divers are extraordinary, aren't they? I mean, it's amazing to watch. Should that mean then that I won't end up with these bubbles of gas forming as I resurface, because the gas is only at atmospheric pressure? That should be the case, but it doesn't always work like this. And the reason is that when these people prepare for their free dive, they do a lot of manoeuvres to force extra oxygen into solution. They breathe and hyperventilate a lot more, which means they will force a bit more nitrogen into the blood. They also do something called air packing. And this is where you force extra air right down into the lungs to really hyperinflate your lungs, to force as much air to dissolve as possible. And then you sink down underwater, and you take that lung volume with you. And of course, as your lungs are compressed underwater, you're going to push more of that oxygen and nitrogen that you've packed into your lungs into solution. So when you then start to resurface, it is possible that as the pressure comes off, you may get bubbles forming, and that's what the bends is. That's where decompression sickness kicks in, because you get bubbles forming in small blood vessels and they interrupt the flow of blood. And this can affect any organ in the body, especially organs with a high metabolic demand and a high blood flow. The brain, the lungs, your heart, liver, kidney, for example, all very susceptible. And it's not just humans that can get this problem. Animals that are very well adapted to deep diving, things like sperm whales, for example, and other whales that can spend time at a kilometre underwater, those animals, if they're scared to the surface too quickly, can get the bends as well. It's rare, but it has been documented. Oh. People have found what are called osteonecrotic lesions, in other words, holes in the bones, in deep-diving mammals like whales, which they believe have been scared to the surface by noises underwater, specifically human noises made by, for instance, people detonating explosives on the seafloor to do seismic surveys, to do geology, to look for, say, oil or gas deposits, for example. So it's not a given just because you're breathing air at atmospheric pressure that if you don't surface very quickly, you can't encourage the formation of some bubbles in your blood vessels, which will give you the bends. The risk, though, is dramatically increased by scuba diving, which is why it's really, really important to follow these resurfacing guidelines, and you come up in a series of steps and you re-equilibrate at different depths to allow the safe release of the dissolved gas from the bloodstream.
You're listening to The Naked Scientist, Dr. Chris Smith. Hi, Dr. Chris. How do creams with sun protection factors in them actually work? Do they actually protect one from the sun, and how does that actually work?
Who sent that one in then? You didn't say who it was.
No, I didn't. I'm just reading it. My producer sent it through. The person did not sign their
name. Oh, okay. Well, anonymous person, how does sun cream work? The way sun cream works is that you have particles in the sun cream which are about the same size as the light waves that can burn you. The light waves in sunshine that will burn your skin are ultraviolet rays. So light goes from red light, which is big wide waves, through to blue and purple light, which are light waves spaced very closely together. And then just beyond that are ultraviolet rays. And allowed into the skin, ultraviolet is sufficiently energetic. In other words, the waves are sufficiently powerful that they can damage your skin. And they can damage the DNA in the cells at the base of the skin. And this is the prelude to getting skin cancer. It also has what's called a photo-aging effect. It breaks down the collagen and elastic tissue in your skin, and this causes wrinkles and makes you look like a prune. Sun cream contains, one very good example, zinc oxide nanoparticles. Mm-hmm. So you can take a chemical where the particles can be made incredibly small, and because those particles are really small and on the same size scale as the light itself, when the light waves come in, they interact with those particles rather than passing through and going into your skin. The particles are made to vibrate effectively. You're soaking up the energy in the light and you turn it into heat, which is infrared energy, in the small particles rather than it penetrating your skin. So you basically just then dissipate the energy back off. The other thing to bear in mind is these sun creams are white, and white because they're reflecting all colours of light. So you're basically reflecting some of the light that comes in off, and the ultraviolet that wouldn't necessarily get reflected, you turn into harmless heat energy within the substance of the sun cream in these nanoparticles, and then it radiates that heat back off from your body surface. It doesn't go into your skin. It doesn't damage the DNA of your stem cells in your skin, and therefore it doesn't lead to cancer.
Now let's go to James in Simonstown. Hi, James.
Oh, good morning. Good morning, Chris.
Hi, James.
Hello there. Jodi Picoult just wrote a fascinating book about parallel worlds, an alternative fate, predestination. I'm a determinist myself. I think it breeds unhappiness if you think you had a different choice in life. But what do you think about parallel worlds?
I'm not really familiar with what a parallel world is. Is this as in like a parallel universe, or are you talking about people having a life course and there are different routes that they can take? I'm not really clear what the term means.
Well, it really means that instead of, as I believe, you know, you have one life, you know, you follow your fate through, you have free will and you have one life. You have choices you could have made in your life that could have been different. You could have had a different... You could have ended up differently. I don't believe this. There is no parallel world choice.
No, I mean, I think that would presuppose that in some way you could exist in multiple places all at the same time and have made different choices at different times. I think that's probably highly theoretical and highly implausible. I think the fact is that time ticks at the rate that time ticks, and what we do today really has consequences for tomorrow and the rest of your life. And that's why it's really important to try and make the best decisions every time. I don't think you have... Life isn't a rehearsal, I think, is basically what I'm trying to say. I don't think that it's practical to think in terms of what I could have done. I think it's important to say I've got one go at everything. Life is not a rehearsal. I'm only on this planet once. I'm going to make the best choices I can and the best decisions and take the best actions every opportunity I have, and aim to have fun, live in the moment, enjoy yourself, enjoy the people around you, and look after the planet. That's my motto.
There we go. James, thank you very much for that, sir. Have a wonderful weekend. There we go. That's James in Simonstown. Let's go to Lindsay in Newlands. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi there. Thanks for a great show.
Thank you, sir.
Chris, I'd like to know, what happens to everything in life that gets sucked into a black hole?
Oh, we'd all like to know the answer to that, because, of course, we don't know. What is a black hole? A black hole is a point in space which has so much mass, is so gravitationally active, that it deforms or distorts the fabric of space, this so-called entity space-time, to the extent that light can't even get out. And this is because you curve space-time and bend light in such a way that light goes into the black hole, crosses an entity called the event horizon, and at that point, the light never comes out. Now, if you look at how we've interrogated the universe around us hitherto, we've used telescopes, and those telescopes have used electromagnetic radiation, in other words, light of some form, in order to see stuff. And because light doesn't come out of a black hole, we therefore can't interrogate what's in a black hole using traditional astronomy and light. So we need to find new ways to understand black holes. We have theories about what's in a black hole. We have theories about how they work. But theories are one thing. Practical experiments to test these theories is another. Now, one big step forward that's happened in recent years to get to the bottom of this has been the discovery and proof of the existence of gravitational waves. This was one of Einstein's predictions from his theory of general relativity, and they were confirmed in 2015 and rewarded their discovery with the conferring of a Nobel Prize for the discoverers. Why gravitational waves matter is because they're ripples in the fabric of space, and anything massive interacting with anything else massive, like a black hole or two big stars interacting, they will cause ripples in the fabric of space which travel unhindered across space and can be detected billions of years after they were formed, in some cases, by detectors here on Earth. So this gives us a new way of understanding these entities and probing them. And so scientists are beginning to use gravitational waves in order to make measurements about black holes and to do tests in order to put some of the theories about how they work to the test so that we can refine our understanding. But no one's been into a black hole that we know of, survived to tell the tale, and then documented what's in there, because even if you did get in there and make those observations, you wouldn't come out again. So at the moment, it remains not just a black hole, but a black box.
Nice one. Lindsay, thank you very much for that. Now, Dagmar asks this question. It was Dagmar, right? So, I understand that itching is meant to attract your attention to a pest feeding at you, and by scratching, you can stop or remove it. So let's talk about itching. I think the question centers around itching. Why do we itch? What is an itch in relation to insects, for example, biting you, and other things?
Itch is a sensation which is conferred on us and carried by a very specific group of nerve fibers. Believe it or not, you do have a population of nerve cells whose sole job is to make you itch. And they are distributed all over the body surface and inside the body in some cases. And when a sensation of itch is detected, what is happening is that those nerves coming from that part of the body have gone active, and they are signaling to the spinal cord that the part of the body that they supply is being irritated. So you therefore get in your spinal cord a signal of where on the body surface this is happening, and it's being told, and this area itches. And that's then sent onto your brain, and it's there to attract your attention. And I guarantee everyone listening to this now, I'm talking about this, will now be thinking, oh, I feel a bit itchy. And people will be scratching themselves because there's a very strong psychological element to this as well. And the reason it has evolved is to defend us from invaders, parasites and other threats. Basically, if there are things trying to burrow through your skin, biting insects that are going to spread a disease to you like malaria from a mosquito, you need to know about it. So your body has evolved this mechanism to draw your attention to a part of its surface that is under threat, And the kinds of stimuli that activate those itch nerves are the kinds of things I've outlined, things that have the potential to damage your skin, infect you with things, or under certain circumstances, just cause irritation chemically. You would then reach to that body part and you scratch it. Why does scratching work? Because what scientists have discovered is that when you cause pain in the skin, and scratching is producing a small amount of pain, the pain nerves go to the same point in the spinal cord that the itch nerves do, and they actually squirt nerve transmitters onto the itch nerves and turn them off. So itching gets your attention, scratching inhibits the itching nerves, but also by the time you're scratching something, you're now paying attention to the body part that was itching, so you're therefore conscious of something, or you've batted away the mosquito or the worm or whatever was trying to get into you, and you focused on that body part that your body needed you to pay attention to. So itching is very, very useful, but when it gets out of control in conditions like eczema, obviously it becomes very destructive and extremely psychologically disturbing. But people who have bad eczema are driven mad by itch. So it's a big priority also coming up with treatments that can make us itch a bit less. And there are some avenues of research that are trying to find better anti-itching drugs.
Chris, as always, great chatting to you, sir. You must have a fabulous weekend and we'll chat next week.
I'm already looking forward to it. Thanks for the great questions, everyone, and have a lovely weekend.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.